Hi, I'm Andalisi. Welcome to episode 35 of Essential Conversations. In 2019, when the British duo Ida May released their album Chasing Lights, produced by Ethan Johns, I talked with them about the influence that American music, specifically blues and jazz, had on them and their music. They were so obsessed that they moved to the U.S. We started by talking about their move from the U.K. to the United States.
Well, we were living in my hometown, and then we moved to London. And we were living in a one-bedroom attic flat in Holloway in central London, where there's 100 languages spoken within a mile of where we lived. And then we came out to Nashville. That was quite the culture shock, I think, for us.
It was, yeah.
It was strange. And it was a real gamble for us as well, you know, coming out here and making that move after we got some visas. Because it's not easy to come to this country. They make it really difficult.
Yeah, you have to get in.
And at that point in your career, what was happening with you musically, and what were you looking at the future, and what juncture were you at when you made that move here?
It was funny you say that, because everything changed on the flight out here. So we had a big plan. This record went through a journey. We recorded it with Ethan Johns, and that was everything with him was wonderful, but we went through two different major labels to get it released, and then it's eventually come out on 30 Tigers. We've been fantastic, but when we moved to Nashville, we'd just finished the record and we'd just gotten the visas, packed everything up, got on the flight. We were signed to a major label.
At that moment in time.
Probably shouldn't mention. We signed to a certain major label. And as we transferred in Iceland, so we're getting a connecting flight in Iceland, we had like a load of missed calls on Chris's phone from management. We're like, that's strange. So we called them back, and we found out in Iceland that the head of the label that we were signed to was leaving, had left the day before, and that all the bands on the label except us
signed
were being dropped that day. And they said, we don't really know what's going on with you guys, but we'll let you know when you get here. And we were like, okay, well, we've just moved our whole lives across the world.
It was a huge transition. Long story short, we were given the option to whether we wanted to stay or go, and then we decided to leave because we had so much trouble with big labels over the years. So it was a huge upheaval even just getting here.
So the move was planned a certain way, and everything changed mid-air. We had an eight-hour flight to think about our lives and what was going to happen.
Because we're used to being the underdog, being
but
British.
But we're quite, and also we're very used to playing. We've been in a band since we were 19, so we're used to things changing on a whim.
That was pretty extreme, though.
And so now you find yourselves with this album out. When were these songs written? How long have these songs been in your lives?
Well, some of them have been in our lives a few years, because there were songs that didn't quite fit, that were half finished, kind of from earlier. And then some of them Ethan really likes to track quickly. So a lot of them he was asking, which are the most recent songs you've written? And because we recorded the album in two halves, the second half of the records, songs like Boom 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 and Higher Than the Light were probably written just a couple of weeks before we went into the studio. So it's a real mix of tracks.
I have to ask you, I've had a fascination with the Real World Studios since I remember Peter Gabriel creating them in the 80s.
Yeah.
But I have never talked to anybody that recorded there. What are those studios like?
Oh, the one in Box. So the one where we recorded is just, it's so beautiful. It's it is like its own world.
It's like a spaceship has landed by this river. It's a really incredible
structure.
It's
like Teletubby land. It's like grass all over the roof.
Cut into the grass almost, yeah. And Ethan tracks in the wood room, which is like an old flour mill, I think. Or
yeah,
storage building.
Mill.
Which has big wooden and stone walls. And they have like a little cottage that you stay in, and they have a chef and everyone that works there, because they run the WOMAD festivals from there. So all of Peter Gabriel's enterprises are in this space. So it's this really nice communal feeling, and you're right by the river. And
in the countryside.
In the countryside, in the middle of nowhere. It's
pretty
idyllic.
It's not the real world, which is funny.
Which is ironic.
It's like a bubble.
It is amazing, and it is a very special place to make music.
And that room sounds beautiful, that wood room as well.
Oh, I remember the drummer Billy Cobham talking about being in the drum booth, and it was over the river or something, and you could see the water beneath. And I thought, man, this place sounds absolutely magical. Leave it to Peter Gabriel, of course. Do you two remember the first time you sang together and what that felt like?
I don't know if we can move. I can remember So we were living in Bath in the UK. We were studying there. And I was playing open mic nights. So I had like this one old Stella guitar that I would take around and I would play out all the time. So I'd play 3 or 4 open mics a week, sometimes 2 a night, just out to play and try and get better. And Steph started coming to my open mic nights. I remember that.
And I was playing jazz recitals and stuff, like playing grand pianos and singing Billie Holiday to people. And I think we played together. You played guitar
before
we sung together.
I pretended I could play jazz guitar.
Pretended very well, threw in some major sevenths.
Yeah.
And then I do remember we had, because we were studying at college and we had one like singing lesson together. And I remember the
teacher
saying,
yeah,
well, your voices go really well together.
Mm-hmm. I think we only did that once. Yeah.
So that might have been the first time we sung together, actually. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's all a bit blurry now, to be honest.
Yeah. It's a long time ago.
Time, yeah.
Yeah.
It is, you know, we talk about sibling harmony and how beautiful, you know, that brothers and sisters sound together, but you two have like what feels like sibling harmony when you sing together.
Oh,
that
you.
Sounds like it was pretty immediate that it felt natural for you guys.
It was real. We got really lucky. And that's what she said. And I remember in this lesson, she was like, you guys are really lucky. This doesn't normally happen, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's weird because Steph can sing much lower than me and I can sing much higher than her. So we're actually kind of the opposite
voices.
Way around. It's just kind of weird. So the way we harmony is weird
really
because
and
Steph is often
below
me.
Sometimes we can't hear
me.
Who's singing. Like there'll be certain moments on the record where
I can't tell.
Me, but it's Chris and like vice versa because we flip a lot. It's really weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Trying not to think about it in case it goes away.
Now when I hear your music, I'm going to be hearing it differently.
See who's
maybe.
Who.
Well, I'm like, who is who? Like, you would have to have this, like, internal, I mean, this unwritten language together to be able to twist those harmonies around and flip them and make it all work. I mean, I'm sure it's not this conscious thing at this point. I would imagine it's not.
Steph's the one that is amazing at harmonies. I'm pretty
Chris
bad.
Has such a wild voice that it goes off and I have to try and follow it.
Yeah. Steph is pretty good at reading my mind now.
Let's talk about the blues, a music that was born in the United States. You guys sound like you're from here, from the U.S. Talk about the influence of blues music on you. I know you went to Robert Johnson's grave site.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about the blues sort of got into your psyche?
Well, it was a big, Detroit had a big part to play in that for me because I was obsessed with the British blues boom, you know, like Peter Green and Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and the Stones and Free and Zeppelin. And then, I mean, really quickly, you start to hear the name Robert Johnson being bandied around. And it was about that time I was listening to the White Stripes and like the Von Bondies and the Go. And the early Kills, like this all the underground Detroit stuff that was happening here, I picked up on it somehow. I can't remember how, and was trying to find CDs from import them and stuff, and because I was just obsessed with it even then. And someone in an interview had mentioned Son House, and then basically once a week in the UK, I went to a CD shop and bought everything Robert Johnson had ever recorded for a fiver. And then the next week it was Blind Willie McTell, and the next week it was Son House, and the next week it was Blind Willie Johnson, and the next week it was Kokomo Arnold. And I did it every week, you know, my pocket money or whatever. And I just became completely obsessed. I'd never heard the level of intensity that kind of one man gunslinger, you know, like Robert Johnson or Son House on his own. I'd never heard anything like that. And when I heard Blind Willie McTell, I was like, I couldn't tell if there was 3 guitars, 7 guitars, what was going on? And I just became obsessed, and they all became my heroes very, very quickly. There was nothing that compared to it in my mind. But I also kind of felt that a little later on, after I'd, you know, sat and listened to all these CDs and imported rare cuts from Germany and stuff, and kind of realized it wasn't my music to play, so that's why we've always kind of shifted and tried to change it in what we do. So just like those guys from the British blues boom, we've tried to regurgitate and twist and change, take those techniques and ideas, but because we often, you know, we've been asked to play a lot of these blues festivals now, and we're not really a blues band, you know. You know, I play some of it and we can do it, but we're not, the record really isn't a blues record. It's just like, you know, it's just inspired. And the funny thing was when I met Steph, Steph was kind of in the same boat, but on the female side of things.
Yeah, I came at it through jazz, so I was studying jazz piano and stuff, and then listening to Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and Dinah Washington, and then I got really into Etta James, and then there's a blues record that Ella Fitzgerald did that was only released in Germany that I had. And the same as Chris is, sort of sadly, but in a CD shop when you're a young teenager, the jazz and blues stuff is really cheap. Like, you can buy, like, everything, you know, Bessie Smith has ever recorded for £4. And everyone else that I went to school with, I grew up in a suburb of London, so everyone's listening to, like, Black Eyed Peas and Miss Dynamite and stuff. And for some reason, I just became obsessed with these big female voices, and then from that gospel and Mahalia Jackson and stuff. And I just couldn't believe that, that you could do that with your voice, you know, similarly to Chris. And it was so moving, and so you don't really know what it's doing to you, but there's, you know, that there's something, you know, that it means something. So, and then we met that way at college, sort of shared a sort of a joint love for the similar
thing. I think we both got a real kick about all of those old artists had their own thing. No one could play like the other, you know, no one could play like Lightning Hopkins, and no one could sing like Bessie Smith. You know, they were each their own thing, which is quite hard to come by growing up, I guess, in the UK, that uniqueness.
So you toured with Greta Van Fleet, and I have to ask you about that because they're from Michigan.
Yeah, man.
And they recorded their last album in just a few miles from here, actually. Mm. What? How did you get on that tour, and what was it like to open for this group?
It was wild for us.
Was it?
It was amazing. You know, I mean, we could have taken anyone.
We just turned up.
It was really sweet.
And we did. We were on tour with Marcus King, and I think they had the same management. And I think Danny, the drummer, was saying they watched some of our music videos somehow. And then out of nowhere, bear in mind, we'd only been here. We'd been on the road with Marcus King and a few other people. And no one really knew who we were. The record wasn't out. All of a sudden, at Christmas time last year, they were looking for an opener for their two sold-out shows at the Fox Theater in Detroit. And they didn't have one. So we got a phone call, I think, like 3 days before, saying, hey, do you want to come and open up at the Fox? We were like, well, yeah, but my God, how? What? Okay. So we turn up anyway, and we'd never played a show that large in our lives. And that theatre is unbelievable. I mean, it gives the Albert Hall a run for its money. It's just astonishing. So we turn up, and our minds are blown, you know. Anyway, we do the two shows, and we kind of say hi to them a little bit. And they stare at my guitar a bit and share some licks or whatever. And then
it all happened very quickly.
Then they asked us to come play in Seattle with them. And then another one. And then we were going to go out with them. They offered us the European tour. And we're like, well, that'd be amazing. And then they cancelled it. But it's a long story. We were halfway across France when we heard that they cancelled it. Anyway, so then they ended up giving us
the US tour instead.
Which is great for us.
And it was just astonishing. I mean, their fan base is unbelievable.
It's like Beatles mania. I've never seen anything like it. They'd have fans cutting through with bolt cutters, you know, through the fences.
To try and see them, you know, like getting ready and stuff.
Every show sold out.
And they're just the sweetest, loveliest kids. And they love music, and like they work so hard at everything. And
you know, they were at the Fox, I don't know if I should say, but they were rehearsing for maybe 4 or 5 hours before doors even opened. You know, they're taking this really seriously.
They take it really seriously, and they know so much
about
music.
And their dad
is
in a blues band, and he's a blues harp player and stuff. So we have a lot in common with those guys. And to watch the spectacle of, like, young people going out and watching roots rock and roll, hearing large Marshall Stacks and a live band for the first time, like, these kids are having a spiritual experience watching that band. And they really care. So for us, it's terrifying for us. We had to play 45 minutes, just the two of us, not a guitar.
And some of the shows were stadiums,
people.
You know. Forest Hill Stadium. Like,
it was a baptism of fire.
It was incredible.
And we learned a lot.
And we just went out on our own with a guy that we know from Norfolk in England. He came and helped drive. There was just three of us.
In Forest Hill Stadium.
Forest Hill Stadium.
No text, no sound man, no nothing.
Oh my gosh.
It was
a wild ride for us, yeah. Yeah, we're indebted to those guys for having us out. Yeah. Good
friends
now.
That's really cool.
Coming up, part two, in the conclusion of my conversation with Ida May.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Here's part two and the conclusion of my conversation with Ida May, in which we talk about the Northern Soul movement in the UK, their rigorous touring schedule at the time, and English and American music.
I'm fascinated brilliant. By the relationship between English and American music because, I mean, it is essentially English. We got our first came here, big folk book of songs collected in Missouri in the 1800s. They're all songs about where we grew up and where your parents were in Ireland.
Yeah, driving around.
And where my dad grows up in North Yorkshire. Everywhere. And then you realise just how short the history is between the two countries.
Yeah.
And that the music, even the blues, you hear European hymnal melodies and that, and, you know, the slide guitar and the whole, I mean, the whole thing is just completely intertwined. So it makes perfect. You know, we get pissed off in the UK when, you know, English magazines will say, why would we write about an English band playing American music when we have American bands playing it? And I'm like, excuse me, like the Beatles, the Stones, like really? Clapton, like, are you kidding me? Like, that you won't write about us? It's a symbiotic relationship, all of these bands, you know what I mean?
Well, if it wasn't for the UK, you know, some of these Motown artists would never have gotten the notoriety and the attention. I mean, it wasn't until Dusty Springfield and, you know, brought all these Motown artists over there, and the Beatles covered tons of their music.
Wilson Pickett and stuff, they were covering and shit like that. And just think about, you know, like Hendrix first made it big over there, White Stripes, Kings.
Oh, yeah, you guys were embraced music from here first.
We've got loads of friends that are Northern Soul DJs, like big guys, like quite well-known guys that are all Northern Soul DJs. Huge scene.
It is remarkable.
And that is a ridiculous. I don't know if you've watched any documentaries on that in the UK, because that is the weirdest thing. So essentially, it's like up north in the mill towns and the coal miners' towns in the UK, somehow in these little working men's clubs, people became obsessed with obscure kind of Motown disco soul hits. And it's like a really, really weird, specific brand of Motown. It's not all Motown necessarily. It's like this weird selection. And that's why no one can really define what Northern Soul is, because it's not really anything.
Yeah.
And like collecting all the badges from all these different working men's clubs, it became the weirdest scene that only listed for a little while. And now it's kind of having a, you know, a renaissance. But it's the weirdest thing. Because no one, even the Northern Soul DJs I speak to, it's like an unknown knowledge of repertoire. Like,
they have their own, like,
it's weird,
their
man.
Own, like rules. Like, you have to play, like, the original.
Serious.
I'm like, I had no idea.
It's a serious thing,
Oh, yeah, it's, like, a really big deal.
This is how the English people feel about this stuff. It's, like, roots American music is treated in the UK. Like, people always say when they come over to the UK how respectful and quiet the audiences are, because we really treat it with reverence. Like, it's an important, it's, like, the bones of rock and roll came from this stuff. So we really treat it with reverence that I don't think it's got over here. Like, when we went out to Clarksdale, and being a naive, you know, English suburban kid, we went out and I couldn't believe it. We were going to where Robert Johnson was exiled and Sunhouse was exiled and Charlie Patton lived. And these are just fucking ghettos. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was going to be like a tourist trail.
It's not preserved or anything.
And people are still living in the same shacks. It blew my mind because these guys are just my heroes. And I assumed that everyone was like, this is a big thing over here. And we got to that Clarksdale Museum. They put Muddy Waters' house where he grew up in there. But everyone is still living in all the other houses. They just picked it up and moved it. And I'm like, this is
crazy.
Heartbreaking man.
You guys...
blew my mind.
You guys have done a way better job of honoring a lot of the music that was made here than we are.
We actually stole, there's preachers on that road trip, our first Mississippi road trip. If you listen to Feeling Getting Closer, there's the preachers off the radio, and also the birds at the beginning. The birds at the beginning of Rightfully Honestly are the birds we recorded above Robert Johnson's grave, stuff like this. So we tried to get a little bit of that atmosphere in there.
That's so brilliant. Oh my God,
what else
I love
we got in there? We got some other stuff, but I've forgotten that.
There's a bar in New Orleans as well.
During this interview, we also talked about the recording process, working with Ethan Johns, and the magic of the first take.
There is magic in a first take and stuff like that.
And just accepting how you sound. You're like, if I do this 100 times, I'm probably only going to sound maybe slightly better or slightly worse. So,
and people are only really reacting emotionally. They're not reacting technically.
Isn't one of the songs on your... wasn't it a demo? Or the...
Easily
Love was like a rehearsal, like a run-through. And then he just secretly kept it.
A lot of them are first takes, yeah.
He did a lot of, let's just run through it.
Should always hit record, right? should always have it going. I mean, those are the moments, you know, that are so magical. And diminishing returns is, I think, there's something to that.
There definitely is. Definitely
start to lose some stuff.
And you have to commit. That's the biggest thing. You have to accept. There's a lot of acceptance in making a record as well. And if you do it 700 times, it's not going to get any better. It's probably going to get worse. Technically, it'll get better, but... And if you haven't got it in 7 takes, then you're not... It's not going to work, you know? Or something, you know what I mean? It doesn't work that way.
Well, you know, technical ability is one thing, but getting an emotional reaction is another.
It's the whole thing,
and that's what matters. That's what makes people listen. You know, people can listen to a great guitar run, doesn't make you want to listen to a song again.
Well, this is the irony. Like, I love guitar, but like, I never want to listen to instrumental guitar music. Like, the best guitar player on the planet, I don't want to listen to that. Yeah. I want to listen to Lightning Hopkins, you know. That's the way it goes. Yeah.
Oh, I have one more question.
Okay.
Best road story.
Best road story.
Crikey.
Oh, there are so many.
We've been on tour in the States for a year on our own, mainly in a car. So a lot of weird stuff happens to us all the time, especially the way we look.
I mean, in Mississippi, they thought we were either sisters or a lesbian couple quite a few times. That's true. Because my long hair, skinny jeans and Doc Martens.
We actually had this is a long story, but I'll do the abbreviated. We're in Clarksdale, Mississippi, the first time we came out to Mississippi, and we went to Club Ground Zero, and the mayor of Clarksdale
thought we were a lesbian couple. So if you're listening. What else do we have? We had gunshots outside the venue in Macon, Georgia. We had a guy ask us if we were French at that particular show.
Y'all
that
French.
Was a good one. This is just how crazy this last six, seven weeks has been. We went from Nashville to a show in Seattle to a show in California. Then we played 3 nights in a casino in Vegas. Then we went back to record with T-Bone Burnett in Santa Monica. Then we drove ourselves across the Mojave Desert, then across Arizona.
To Telluride.
Then into Colorado. We played 4 shows in 3 days in Telluride at 10,000 feet, which nearly killed us. Then we played in Denver. Then we flew to London for 12 hours. Then we flew to Switzerland, played in the medieval church. Then the next night we played on the Reeperbahn in Hamburg to 500 people. Then the next night in Amsterdam. Then the next night in Paris. Then we flew to Spain. We played in a speakeasy. Then we drove ourselves halfway across Spain, played in like a terrible rock bar. Then we drove ourselves back to Germany, played in Berlin, Hamburg, Berlin, somewhere else and somewhere else.
Then we flew to Milan.
Then we flew to Milan. We played in Milan. Then we drove ourselves across Italy into Tuscany to play a wedding. Then we flew back to the UK. Then we flew out back to Nashville.
We had a week off. Now we're on this tour.
And we went to Virginia, New York. And then wherever we were last night and now here.
Basically, we can't say no is the...
it's not glamorous. And that's just us in a car, you know, and 2 guitars carrying our amps in our hand luggage.
We're just going at it.
You know.
It's a good thing you guys like each other.
So talking about tour stories, I mean, there are so many things.
Today, actually, we just got a sandwich and the girl said to Chris, I need to find my friend because we've always spoken about hearing an English accent in real life and I never thought I'd hear one and she needs to hear this. This is incredible. Chris was like, thank you.
We went to another place in Ohio, pizza restaurant. Steph orders, oh, can I just get a small margarita pizza? And the girl behind the counter just goes, oh, and puts her hand over her mouth and doesn't say anything for like 10 seconds. She's like, oh. I just nothing.
I was like, what? What's happened?
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, so we get...
It's constant. Oh, we were in Philadelphia. We were told to go back home as well.
Someone told me to go back to where I came from.
That's a new one.
I'm so sorry about that. Oh, man.
I mean, the list is endless. Yeah. But I mean, all the tour stuff has been amazing. Going out with Greta, we played with them in Madison, Wisconsin. Went on stage with them to one of the biggest crowds I think they'd played to. And we'd ever seen. It was amazing.
Yeah, and we've met something. Everyone's so lovely, you know. We always go to the merch stand and we meet everyone. And
we have some amazing fans now.
We've got some lovely, lovely fans and people that you see a lot. Like already, we've only been here a year and there's sort of people that have seen us 5 times, which is incredible, you know.
Yeah, so. And just joining people on stage, like Marcus King joining him on stage and Blackberry Smoke. And we played another festival in Nashville where Emmylou Harris introduced us on stage. We played her festival.
That's a good, yeah, that was mad.
And we only had a line check, so we ran on stage and we were plugging things in.
And she was filling for time.
So she was introducing us whilst filling for time.
And I couldn't concentrate because like, Emmylou Harris is next to me filling for time. And I'm trying to set up and I was like, I just want to hug Emmylou Harris.
It was the weirdest thing. And then backstage meeting Tommy Emmanuel and stuff, and he's playing my guitar and stuff. This, I mean,
it's been surreal.
It's been an amazing year.